AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Jackson Hewitt.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Hundreds of people in Richmond, Indiana, who live near a large industrial fire with thick black smoke, have been told to evacuate. The flames broke out in an area where plastics are stockpiled. Indiana State Fire Marshal Steve Jones from WTTV-TV.
The smoke is definitely toxic, and so I know we've put out an evacuation within a half mile, I believe is what it is. And so we don't want the residents in the smoke.
No reports of injuries. Police in Louisville, Kentucky have released the body cam video from yesterday's bank rampage that killed five people. More from CBS's Steve Futterman.
The body cam footage shows the first two Louisville police officers who respond to the shooting. When they arrive, gunfire can clearly be heard. At several points, we hear Officer Corey Galloway as the suspect fires on them.
He's shooting straight through these windows, right towards the officer.
The other officer, Nicholas Wilt, was critically wounded. That portion was not shown.
The shooter has an angle on that officer. We need to get up there.
Eventually, the gunman is shot and killed. Steve Futterman, CBS News.
Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, a Democrat, files a federal lawsuit against Republican Congressman Jim Jordan. Bragg is asking a judge to invalidate subpoenas that the House Judiciary Committee chairman has or plans to issue as part of an investigation of the district attorney's handling of the Trump case. WCBS-TV's Marcia Kramer on what Bragg is saying.
Chairman Jordan's subpoena is an unconstitutional attempt to undermine an ongoing New York felony criminal prosecution and investigation, Bragg said, claiming the subpoena, quote, is an unprecedented, illegitimate interference by Congress that lacks any legal merit and defies basic principles of federalism.
CBS News has learned that the Biden administration has started giving the Congressional Gang of Eight access to the classified documents that were recovered from the homes of former President Trump, President Biden, and former Vice President Pence. CBS's Catherine Herridge reports.
It's very significant that some of the records that were recovered at the former president and current president's homes and the vice president are being shared with Congress. These lawmakers see this as a victory for oversight for the legislative branch because they feel that they have a right to understand what the national security implications are.
The Democratic National Committee chooses Chicago to host the 2024 Democratic National Convention. Mayor Lori Lightfoot.
Jobs, jobs, jobs is what this is about, and an ability to showcase our great city on an international stage.
Chicago beat other cities, including Atlanta, Houston, and New York. Disgraced Theranos CEO Elizabeth Holmes loses her bid to stay out of prison and must surrender on April 27th. This is CBS News.
Taxes are due. Have you filed yet? Don't worry. Jackson Hewitt is racking up the assists. They will get you filed or an extension before the deadline. Beat the crowds by going to Jackson Hewitt.
A progressive voice from Manitowoc to Janesville. WAUK 540 AM. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matnair. Here's what you need to know. A bill is being reintroduced at the federal level to further distinguish dairy from non-dairy products. The CURD, or Codifying Useful Regulatory Definitions Act, will create a formal definition of natural cheese. It will also require all ingredients be listed on the labels. Senators Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson both support the measure. The FDA would need to agree to the new standards before the act would be passed in all states. Central and southern Wisconsin at a very high level of fire risk. All counties south of Marathon are listed at a very high fire danger level, according to the DNR, which warns that grass fires can pop up very quickly. If you need to burn something, make sure you have the proper permits and have water close by. The DNR responded to more than 30 wildfires in just the last week. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News.
Direct from the Dairy State, it's Extra Sharp Weekends, a three-hour block of Wisconsin-produced radio, Saturdays and Sundays from 11 a.m. till 2 p.m., featuring Raised in Wisco with Joel Clayfish and Danielle Fairman, The Cripes Cast with Charlie Behrens, and Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, Gilbert Brown. Enjoy it by the slice or enjoy the whole darn block. Extra Sharp Weekends is radio so fresh, it squeaks. Listen in on the Civic Media Station or on the app.
Max Inc. Radio with Dennis Graham from Rockonson.
Appreciate all the support of Mad Radio 92.7. And by the way, a tip of the hat to Civic Media. That was a great article on the Cap Times by Paul Fanlon. You guys got a great model that you're growing around the state, local interest with radio stations throughout these different markets. And a tip of the hat, and you're focusing on local music and nobody's doing it. So great job.
Listen to Max Inc. Radio Saturday night, 6 to midnight on the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm Pat Kreitlow from Up North News. On an earlier edition, we talked to three women, med students, about whether they're going to stay in Wisconsin to practice medicine.
All this Roe v. Wade stuff, and now OBGYN's hands are so tied. I don't want to go through 12 years of training to have some person that didn't do training tell me how to do my job.
It is not a binary choice. You're for or against abortion. It is a healthcare decision. We all have those stories, and people want to hear them.
Don't miss the real stories here on Up North News.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk from Butler to Windlake. Always streaming at waukradio.com. The Shaw 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM, Wisconsin's home for rational talk.
Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some good news coming out of Maryland. Their governor, Governor Wes Moore, he has signed into law an increase in the minimum wage. Pennsylvania is still waiting for you. It's been, what's it been? 17 years since we've raised the minimum wage here in Pennsylvania on the state level. Well, Maryland has raised it to, starting next January 1st, $15 an hour. That is a good thing. They say it's going to help about 126,000 Maryland households. We will see. I think it's a step in the right direction. It's about damn time. And here to share some thoughts on how important this is and why business should be behind it, I've asked Aaron Saetti on to come talk with us. Aaron is the owner of Well Paid Maids, their website, wellpaidmaids.com. Aaron, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, of course. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So were you at the event today where the governor signed this into law?
Yes, I was. I didn't get my pen, but I was there. They're giving out free pens.
I've got my pen from when Rendell signed it back in 2006. And I'm going, I hope there's going to be another one next year. And it's that was what I said to him, and there hasn't been one for a lot of years. So tell me about the event.
It was a very kind of triumphant event. Governor Moore was there to tout not only this, but an increase in the child tax credit for Maryland workers as well, as part of a push against child poverty. It's a big issue in Maryland, like it is everywhere, really. And one concern in Maryland is also that in recent years, we passed a large education bill. The Kerwin Act that funnels a lot more money into education, but recent statistics that have been released on child poverty in the state of Maryland and how that would interface with that education law indicates that it's going to cost a lot more than they thought it would, and so it's kind of related to that, but of course it's its own issue on its own legs.
So now this is a pretty big jump up to $15 an hour, because I remember the first iteration of this, it was an incremental thing, if I remember right. But this is a jump, from this January 1st, it's $15 an hour. That's a pretty sizable jump from where it is right now, isn't it?
Yeah. So somewhere around $13 right now. And so it'll be a significant jump to happen in, less than a year? Absolutely. But, that's one thing, too, that I'm kind of, as I've been advocating for this minimum wage increase and others, is that, what sounds scary, what sounds as like, wow, that's a jump. And it is. It's great for workers. The thing that we constantly hear from the business community is, the sky is going to fall. It's going to kill us. It's going to put us out of business. But, when I think of running my own business, the idea that there's going to be some marginal increase to the wages we pay, whether it's $1 or $2 or something like that, it's really not something that's top of mind for me. And I really challenge the idea that it's what keeps other business owners awake at night.
Now, also one of the arguments I make, and I got to ask, as a business owner, when are you moving to Pennsylvania? Because we're told now that the minimum wage is going to be $15 an hour, more than double what it is here in the state of Pennsylvania, still at $7.25 because of the federal increase. Pennsylvania state law is still $7.15. You should be moving to Pennsylvania. We got cheap exploitable labor here.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, it's an opportunity to, I think, do a lot of good. And because, you know, there is an unfortunate dynamic, which is folks in state capitals care about what people who own businesses say more than they care about what workers say or what, you know, union representatives say. And so, you know, like it or not, having business voices to say, you know, this bill is actually not just not a problem, but it's something that's good for business and ultimately good for all of us is something that's really useful. So I agree with you. We should be in Pennsylvania, and I think it would be an asset to you know, the fight to raise minimum wage there.
Yeah, but I got to think that your business wouldn't operate well out of Pennsylvania. I got to assume your clients are going to be in Maryland, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have a branch in New York City, and so it's just about a year old, and so, you know, we'll see how that goes. But in theory, you know, there's nothing to preclude a well-paid Mates Pittsburgh, a well-paid Mates Philadelphia. So I'm totally open to the idea.
There you go. So, you know, in talking about how this benefits the local community, because I've been making this argument for years that when working people have more money in their pockets, they're able to go and support Main Street, and that an increase in the minimum wage should be celebrated by small businesses. Because that increase in wages is really their money. It's the money walking into the door. It's really the big corporations. It's the National Federation of Small Businesses. It's the NFIB. It's the Restaurant Association. It's those people who are really fighting it. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, just this past like Christmas season, we had an employee, you know, she told me like, hey, this is the first year that I could afford to buy a real Christmas tree, right? And that's like a really small thing, but it's a nice example because you know what, like the NFIBs of the world would have you believe is like, oh, you're going to put this poor Christmas tree farm in Western Maryland out of business with this, you know, marginal increase in the minimum wage, you know, a few bucks here and there. But the real story is that, no, you know, their line can be, you know, twice as big next year because more people have more money in their wallets to spend. And so I think that, you know, when you think of like what are business problems, the biggest business problem is, you know, do I have customers and am I going to have more this year than last year? Not will one of my costs increase by, you know, some small factor.
Now, the other part of this, and again, this is kind of the recurring conversation around, you know, it's one of those which side are you on parts. As an employer, you want people who are going to be qualified. You're going to want your best people. You're going to want them to stay. You're going to pay them a little bit better so that they do stay. And this raising of the floor, I think, gives people the option that they don't have to go chasing nickels at every opportunity, no?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've calculated that turnover in our company costs around $6,000 per employee, and that's for the cost of advertising the job again, you know, buying a new set of equipment and supplies, interviewing candidates, training new people. And so, you know, this kind of churn and burn model that a lot of employers are addicted to, I think that people fall into that trap because oftentimes the costs associated with it are not very visible. And so they think of it as something they're doing to save money. But if you actually do an honest accounting of how much it costs you to constantly be firing people or having people quit because, you know, you're not paying good wages, not paying good benefits, I think it's a really favorable profile in terms of the accounting to say, you know what, it makes sense to be an employer that pays a living wage and offers a full benefits package because the fewer people we've got coming out the door means that, you know, we can grow. And that's ultimately how you have a good result in business.
No, that's a good thing. The one downside to this, they didn't index this to inflation. And that's one of the things that just drives me insane, that we could solve this problem once and for all. You get it to a reasonable wage and that never allow it to be eroded by inflation. Again, make sure that it continues to go up as it needs to. Or look, in some states, if it goes backwards, it goes backwards. But that index, I think, is so important.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, it's the whole reason we're doing this speed up. The whole reason this is a priority that people understand is because of, you know, the incredible inflation we've had over the past few years and how, you know, what folks thought was a high number, what back when the law was originally passed is starting to look like not such a high number. So it is unfortunate that indexing didn't make it in. It was one of the governor's priorities. And, you know, it's important to remember, you know, Maryland is controlled by Democrats. And so the people that, you know, decided that they don't want indexing to be a part of this are other members of, you know, the democratically controlled legislature. From my understanding, it pertains to wanting to be able to have this power in years to come, to basically be the folks that every year meet and could decide this. And of course, a lot of things flow from that in terms of being able to fundraise off of it, being able to run on it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's stupid.
Reverse incentives.
Because here's the thing. I mean, $15 an hour next year is great. I mean, it's good. It's a good huge step in the right direction. It's still not at the front of the pack. I mean, you're kind of somewhere, you know, there are a lot of states that are further down the road. I look at New York is talking about raising the minimum wage up to, what $21 an hour?
Yeah, $21.25.
Now, if you live in New York City, I think you need that. But the rest of the state, I understand there's a lag that, as this bill that they've got is been thrown out, there's a year lag to get up to that. But still, $21 an hour, that's a reasonable wage. That's something you can put a roof over your head. You can put food on the table for the kids. There's dignity in that. That's where we should be fighting for.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think the living wage movement is, smartly polishing off this, fight for 15, bill of goods. And we need to quickly kind of rejigger our aims and our goals to a higher number. Inflation is still here. And not only do we need that higher anchoring number, we need to make sure it's chained to CPI so that we can stop doing this, right? Yeah, it's a waste of everyone's energy. There are other things to focus on in terms of having a more pro-worker economy than just the minimum wage. And the fact that we have to keep doing this year after year, term after term, means that, all the effort of, advocacy groups and labor unions, et cetera, businesses like me, it's just kind of rinsed and reused on this same topic.
Drew, listening at KTNF in Minnesota, asks, why not raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour if you're going to raise it at all? I'm so tired of that argument. Doesn't that make you angry when people throw out these ridiculous numbers and you go, why not just make it $100 an hour? Because that's stupid, Drew. We don't. It's not going to happen. But yeah, let me ask you, why not raise it to $100 an hour?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we still need businesses that are employing people to be financially viable, and so we can't throw out numbers that would ruin the economics of any enterprise. But I think that I always like the term living wage. I think the idea, and I think that resonates with people, the idea that at a bare minimum, jobs shouldn't pay less than it actually costs to live and have a normal life on, is something that's deeply rooted in American history and politics. It's not a radical thing to ask for, and it's where people's heads are and should be at in terms of what ought the minimum wage be.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Aaron Saadian. Aaron is the owner of Well Paid Maids, their website, wellpaidmaids.com. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that and reward Aaron for his willingness to come out and fight for his workers and all workers. Now, one of the things that I've always been in favor of is instead of a minimum wage, is more like a prevailing wage, where it's like in the construction trades, where it's, you figure out how much it costs for that job. You give people the ability to locally craft a wage. It's going to ensure that they can afford rent and bills and food on the table and that kind of stuff, and push for that as opposed to just kind of flat line. $21 an hour, like I said, in New York City, that might get you by. You're going to do probably really well in upstate New York. So there's this view of mine that maybe a prevailing wage is something we should really be talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good example of something where if we could index on a high minimum wage and put this to bed, there are all kind of things people dream up, like sector boards and things like that, bargaining across industries or wage setting and things like that. But it's also kind of speculative and fantastical because we keep having to pour all of our energy into this topic time and time again. But yeah, I can think of a lot of schemes that would make sense.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to move that along, because there are a lot of good ideas out there. But if we're still talking about just bare minimums, if we've got to fight this hard to get the bare minimum raised up a little bit, there's something wrong with that. Last question I've got for you, going forward, as you said, the Democrats in Maryland wanted to hold on to this for future opportunities, fundraising, elections, whatever. What should working people do? Is this the end of the road? Where does this go from here? And what would you advise for working people in states that haven't raised their minimum wage?
Well, I think that, you know, it's important for everyone to know how well organized the business community is in every state capital in America. And so, you know, I've testified on this issue in Richmond, Maryland, you know, at the federal level. And, you know, the lobbyists kind of, they just bubble out of the floor, right? They're there every day. They know everybody's names. And you know, by and large, except for a few large labor unions, they're there to represent the business community. And so I think the more that folks can actually show up and advocate for you know, these types of bills to pass, and also to tell their personal stories of you know, how they've been impacted by, you know, maybe what they've not been able to receive as a worker, or what they've not been able to do for their family. I think it can only have a strong impact.
Now, in fact, the thing you just said there is the most important part of it, that workers need to understand how organized the business community really is. I think that is important. But Aaron, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Good on you for standing up for working people. I appreciate your time. Hope folks will take a look at the website, wellpaidmaids.com. We'll get links out on social media. Aaron Sayedian, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Eric. Bye-bye.
Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show for working people on the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, that comment Aaron made right there, I think it's the most important part of the whole discussion. Yeah, it's great that Westmore raised the minimum wage up to $15 an hour. We should have been indexed. I'm just saying, wish that would have happened. But you know, saying, you know, working people don't realize how well organized the business community really is, how organized the moneyed interest of this country really is, because they get what they want. Matt, think about this for a second. You know, in my state of Pennsylvania, they have not raised the minimum wage in our state house for 17 years. Last time it happened was 2006. Ed Rendell was governor. We went through, you know, Tom Corbett. We went through, you know, Tom Wolf. We've now got Josh Shapiro. All those years. He went through a term with Ed Rendell. All those years, no increase. And I remember at the time getting the pen, because, you know, I think I still have it. It's in a little frame. And because it was one of the first times that I go, wow, let me give you a pen. It doesn't write. Just so you know, it's purely ceremonial. And that was one of those things that just cracked me up. But it you got the shell anyway. But anyway, I mean, you know, it was one of those things, and I said, I go, now, do we get one next year? Because are we going to make this, you know, are we going to make this better? And the answer was, yeah, oh yeah, we're gonna work harder, because one of the things that Republicans got in that 2006 law was preemption laws. They were, and again, this is where organized money, they understand what they're doing. They know, the business community knows what they're doing. They spend a lot of money on think tanks to preempt down the road. And what they did is they said, yeah, we're gonna allow you to raise the minimum wage back in 2006 up to $7.15, because I still remember the chant, 7:15, nothing in between. And there's been nothing in between now and then either. They would not, they had put it in there that it had to be raised at the state level. That means Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, Altoona, Erie, Allentown, none of those places could increase their minimum wage locally. And they were smart about it. Look, they knew that there would be organizing going on in places where the cost of living is a little bit higher. So, you know, they made it to where you're just stuck. And look, in those places, and this again, this is that rural-urban war that's been going on for a very long time. You've got these rural representatives who don't know what it costs to live in a city and don't care about those because they're not their constituents, sticking it to the urban areas by saying, no, you can't raise your minimum wage even just a little bit. And this, you know, because I listen to the Marjorie train wrecks and all of them. And, you know, they say, well, it's the left that's done this. No, this has been going on for a very long time. And it's this kind of pit, back and forth that goes on that's created the environment we're in, which is why I'm a prevailing wage guy. I think if you have a wage in an area, you say this is what the wage for this job is, and it's paid for everybody. So that we go back to competing on, again, service and quality and who can do the most productive job instead of who's willing to sacrifice sacrifice their kids' future. For me, the way forward is work should make your life better. One of the things I agreed with Ronald Reagan on is, the best anti-poverty program is a job. And I've amended that to be a union job, one with good wages and health care and retirement security and a voice on the job. That's the future. But sadly, we've got too many in our state houses across this country who, they're bought and paid for by the organized money. I remember all the ALEC legislation that was, for a while, everyone was finding. You think that's gone away? No, they're just hiding it better. So, again, good on Maryland. I wish they would have inflated it. They would have pegged it to inflation so they wouldn't have to keep doing this. But here we are. I want to get to this real quick. Reality, most Americans, according to the most recent Pew Research poll, is supportive of the medical abortion pills that the Texas judge has just made illegal. And 53% of adults say that they're in favor of this. And what I find interesting is since, and this is where Republicans really have a problem, because they're losing a generation. What has come out, the 538 blog has come out and said that there are around 66,000, almost 67,000 people who are unable to receive a legal abortion in their home state between July and December of last year. And that number includes more than 43,000 people who are unable to receive abortion because their state banned it. So the question, Arizona, South Carolina, Ohio, Georgia, North Dakota, Indiana. So you go, what did these people do? They said an additional 22,680 whose home states severely restricted or reduced it as well. What did these people do? Did they have children? And can they afford them? Did they put them up for adoption? This is kind of where my mind is going. What's happening since we're forcing people to have children? What's going to be the consequence of this? And the social spending that's going to go up with it, because we haven't seen conservatives really pushing the kind of legislation that I think needs to be done. And you don't see them pushing, jobs programs. You don't see them. It's one of those things where you go, we're going to make you do this, but we're not going to help you get to a place where you can actually do it. And that's the frustrating part. As I've said in the past, I personally am not in favor of abortion. I think it should be safe and legal. I don't want poor working class women dying in alleys because we know rich women are going to get whatever they need. I don't want my daughters being in that position. But I think we should be passing laws to encourage people to say, you know what, if you do have a kid, that kid's not going to go hungry. That kid's not going to, not have medical care, not going to have an opportunity to get an education. We should be full tilt boogie moving toward policies to encourage people instead of forcing them. And this is where Republicans, I think, are going to continue for the next several election cycles to take a real thrashing. And I think this Nancy Mace, this representative from South Carolina, I think she's getting it. I think she's got it, actually, because she's saying that, you know, the FDA and the people who are in charge of this medical abortion pill shouldn't listen to this judge, because she understands that there are Republicans who are in favor of this.
A progressive voice for rural Wisconsin. WAUK 540 AM. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. Toxic smoke coming from a Richmond, Indiana industrial fire has prompted evacuations. State Fire Marshal Steve Jones.
If there's a lot of smoke, they need to get out of it. They need to find a temporary place to stay. And honestly, this fire is going to burn for a few days.
Louisville, Kentucky police released body cam video worn by the responding officers during a deadly shooting at a downtown bank yesterday. Deputy Police Chief Paul Humphrey.
Not a single person received any further injury once officers arrived on scene, and that's what we're here for.
Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg files a lawsuit against Representative Jim Jordan to stop a House Judiciary Committee inquiry over his indictment of former President Trump. Loyola Law School professor Lori Levinson.
This is a state prosecution, and it's really hard to see how Jordan makes a legitimate argument for seeking this type of intrusive discovery into the prosecutor's work in Manhattan.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
The Shaw 101 FM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. We know the names of the two police officers shot and killed during a traffic stop in northwest Wisconsin Saturday. They're Hunter Scheel and Emily Breidenbach.
It's tragic. It's terrible. We shouldn't have to be here and talk about this, but we have to time and time again across this country.
That's Barron County Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald. Funeral planning is underway. Wisconsin's U.S. senators are trying again to keep anything not made with milk from being labeled as cheese. Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson are proposing a bill to create a legal definition of natural cheese and require all ingredients to go on labels. The Food and Drug Administration and all 50 states would have to sign on. In sports, the Brewers lost to the Diamondbacks last night. Corbin Burns starts for Milwaukee tonight. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens, inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripescast, where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a six-pack of Jolly Good. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good.
As a veteran of our country's armed services, you may be experiencing hardships, but we are clear in our mission. No Wisconsin veteran should ever have to face homelessness or lose heat, power, or water again. Apply today by calling 833-WIS-VRAP. That's 833-947-8727. Visit VRAPWI.com.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis. Every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., we talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
What is dedication?
People ask, how your children learn how to ride a bike and you didn't. I just created an environment where they taught themselves and all I had to do was be there.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Story of real news affecting real people and democracy itself. So how many Gannett newspapers do you guess are covering it?
to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday, the teaching staff at Rutgers University went on strike. Now, this is important because this is the first time these staff members have gone on strike in 256 years. So you go, how? Why? Why? I guess the big question is why? Especially when you look at, you know, Rutgers University has been one of, in, at least in my thought, one of the leaders in labor education and all of that. So what forced all this? Well, they're trying to stick up for the part-time workers, the part-time professors, the part-time workers, the people who higher ed has been screwing for the last several years, and good on them. And here to share some thoughts on what's going on at Rutgers, especially now that the Rutgers president, this Jonathan Holloway, has said that if they don't come up with something in the next couple of days, he may go to the state and make them legal action. That's why, this is crazy to me. That's why I've asked Cindy Hamavich to come talk with us. She is a history professor at the University of Georgia. She's also the LACHA president, the Labor and Working Class History Association, their website, LACHA.org. Cindy, thanks for taking time for us.
Nice to talk to you.
So I'm looking at this, and the first strike action in 256 years, is that right?
Well, I'm looking at the same things you're looking at, and that's what they say. It's quite remarkable.
I mean, it is remarkable, and it's remarkable what's happened in the field of higher education around, you know, what used to be solid, you know, middle class wage employment and careers. We've now turned this into, you know, people need five or six of these gigs just to make ends meet.
Yeah, that's right. For many people in this profession, you know, the ivory tower is looking more and more like a coal mine. They're just a majority of people who are teaching university students are contingent laborers. So they're hired either by the year or by the course. And there's no job security. If you're being paid by the course, then you have to teach a huge number of courses in order to make a living.
And you know, that's not, you know, I don't know how that's conducive to the education that students get. I don't know how it's conducive to the study of the field of the person who's teaching the course. This just doesn't seem to be the right direction for me.
No, I don't think it is. I mean, I certainly have colleagues who are contingent faculty members who are fantastic, who are incredibly devoted teachers, and some universities have tried to make a kind of quasi-permanent status where they'll promote people who are on these contingent contracts, which allows them to have longer-term contracts, like a five-year guarantee. But it's still an insecure position, and then there are many, many more people who are far more insecure than that. And, you know, there's only so much you can do when you're teaching four, five, six courses at a time. How much time can you spend on each student? How much time can you spend in office hours? What happens several years later when a student needs a letter of recommendation and they have no idea where you've gone? You know, it's hard on the faculty members for sure, but there are also consequences for how we run our universities and the experience that students have as well.
Yeah, and when I saw this story, I'm like, good on these professors and these workers for standing up. 256 years without a work action like this is impressive, but sadly just, I guess, a sign of our times. But the reason I reached out to you guys at LACHA, you guys came out with a statement that said, look, if this strike goes on any much longer, we have an event scheduled somewhere near the campus, on the campus.
Oh, it's not just an event. It's our conference that we hold every 2 years. It moves around, and it just so happens to be hosted this year by the great folks at the Labor Center at Rutgers. And lo and behold, they're on strike. So.
Yeah, and your events are fantastic. I've been to two of them over the years, and I find them just fascinating. But the reason I bring this up is you said, look, if this continues, we're not crossing the picket line. We're going to stand with these folks, and we'll have to move our conference somewhere else. And I said, you know, this is important to point out and to give, you know, recognition where due, is saying, look, you know, we're standing with these people. I think we need to reinforce that across society.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no way we can ask several hundred labor historians to cross a picket line. It's just not going to happen. It would be a Herculean effort to move this conference off campus. I mean, we have, you know, seven sessions going at any one time. So it'll be really hard and it'll be expensive to do it, but we don't really feel like we have any choice in the matter. This is such an important event, and we support it.
Yeah, see, I think the best thing to do is don't have the event anywhere else. Just do it on the picket line. That would be a real...
Well, that would be great, and certainly one of our members, you know, suggested to me, well, could we do it outside? But you have to imagine seven sessions at once, some of them big, some of them small, people needing, you know, you need to be able to hear. And it just wouldn't work. Many of us had the experience of teaching college classes outside as a result of the pandemic. And boy, it didn't work really well. It's fine if you have, you know, eight students and you can sit in a little circle, but in the, you know, if you're trying to talk to 200 or 30 or 50, there's no way.
Yeah, I have this vision in my head. You could just do like the Occupy People's Mic thing. I mean, this could be a real show.
You're giving me a headache just thinking about it. But we have some other locations in mind, and we're talking to them and figuring out, you know, the logistics and the costs and so forth. And hopefully this will be long over by the time our conference begins, which is May 18th, but we'll see.
Yeah, no, the hope is that it will be quick, because, look, nobody wants to go on strike. I've been in strike, yeah. On strike during my working career. It's not something I wanted, but, you know, sometimes you have to do what you have to do. It is the last arrow in the quiver. But, again, the reason that I wanted to talk to you is I think it's important to show people how to support people on strike, and sometimes you have to sacrifice, and being part of a community is important, and you know, what's the old saying, you know, the bigger the strike, the shorter the strike, the more people on the picket line, the shorter the strike. This could be one of those
moments.
Absolutely.
Well, they had incredible support for the strike among the union members. I mean, it was an overwhelming vote, so that doesn't seem to be an issue.
Now, in looking at this, and again, you're obviously not in the negotiations and all of this.
Oh, no, no. Yeah.
And I don't expect you to say, I know what's going on. But this had to get to a point to where these folks were just feeling they weren't getting anywhere with the administration. And again, being the last arrow in the quiver, it's what you have to do sometimes, isn't it?
Well, the thing that's so interesting to me is this is a university that has multiple unions, and I used to work at York University in Toronto, and it too had multiple unions, you know, a union for faculty, a union for the contingent people, a union for the grad students, for staff, and so forth. So this these multiple unions have come together. They're not negotiating separately. They've formed a coalition. And you have, you know, tenure track, much more secure faculty walking out in support of the people who are, you know, much more vulnerable among them. So it's really important for that reason as well.
No, it's one of those events that, you know, you just wow. How did it get to this point? You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Cindy Hajimovich. She is a history professor at the University of Georgia, also the president of LACHA, the Labor and Working Class History Association. I did want to ask you about the event, and, you know, hopefully people who will be in the Rutgers area in the middle of May, you know, maybe can attend. Tell me what it is you guys do, and and why, why it's important.
Absolutely. Well, Latcha is has been around for over a quarter of a century now, and we're an organization made up of historians, but other people who study, who are interested in labor, by union members, K through 12 teachers, archivists, all sorts of people who are interested in history and who are especially interested in labor and working class history. And we have a fantastic journal, which is called Labor Studies in Working Class History, which you can you get if you become a member. And we keep our membership dues low so that people can afford it. And we have, you know, different scales for people with different resources. And we meet every 2 years. We have our journal in between. We do all sorts of programming in the interim, some things in person, some things online. And one of the things we do, for example, is we have a fantastic committee that trying to create resources that teachers can use in their classrooms to teach labor and working class history. So, for example, they ask historians to take a primary document, something from the past that they like to teach with, that they think is really revealing, and then kind of unpack it for the teacher so that sort of they know what a historian you know, is seeing in it, and then sort of helping to guide a conversation about it so a teacher can read it, think about it, plunk it into their curriculum. It's not a whole lesson plan because teachers make their own lesson plans. They know what they're doing much better than we do. The idea is to get working class history into classrooms and, you know, for people to understand this really fascinating path. So the organization does lots of things, and anybody can join.
No, it's important, the work that you guys do. In fact, you know, I love having labor historians on to talk about, you know, what has happened in the past, and more importantly, how the past, you know, affects the, you know, the current and possibly the future. In fact, you know, we just had my friend Eric Loomis on talking about tomorrow's the 89th anniversary of the electric auto light strikeout, the Battle of Toledo, if you will, and understanding why it's important to remember that, because sadly, our education system doesn't do a very good job of teaching working class history.
No, unfortunately, it doesn't. I mean, I certainly didn't get any of it when I was in school, and I was in a great school system. But it's just, you know, I think in probably some parts of the country, it may have penetrated a little bit more. But, you know, other than a couple of mentions of the Industrial Revolution and John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie, you're off to something else.
Yeah, I learned about the Molly Maguires, and I learned they were all criminals. And yeah. You go, wait a second, now that I'm older and you look back and you go, yeah, that's the corporate view. I get that. I got the corporate view of labor education.
Yeah. No, it's important. It's something really important that we do. And we also try to, you know, well, increasingly this organization, which really started out as an organization for academics, has become an organization that supports the organizing on campuses as well, because we're not just studying, you know, coal miners and textile workers. We are now subjects of labor history as well, because the conditions on our universities have declined so much. So we also support organizing efforts. We have, for example, a day-long organizing workshop for graduate students on the first day of the conference.
It's a lot of good work you guys do. I hope folks will check out the website, lawcha.org, LAWCHA.org. We'll get links out on social media. Any words for the people on the picket line there at Rutgers? Anything?
Oh, well, we're just so proud of them and supportive. And we hope that your listeners will contribute to the strike fund. And I should mention that the graduate students at the University of Michigan, the graduate TAs, teaching assistants, including my son, are also on strike. So that's another strike fund to contribute to. And we wish them all the best and solidarity.
Yeah. Workers fighting for dignity is a good thing. Cindy, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Nice to talk to you.
You as well. Cindy Hamovich, she is, as I said, a history professor there at the University of Georgia. Make sure you check out the LACHA website where she's the president. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have the time. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1941. For years, auto workers had participated in a series of sit-down strikes and walkouts. They had won union recognition from almost every major automaker in the country. But the Ford Motor Company, the giant of the American auto industry, would not budge. Ford used many tactics to undermine unionization. He hired many black workers with the idea that a racially divided workforce would be less likely to work together. He enlisted Detroit area pastors to recruit his workers. If a pastor would not support Ford's anti-union stance, then no members of that church would be hired. Ford also raised employee wages in an effort to win their loyalty. Ford created the Ford Service Department. The 8,000-member department included uniformed security who kept an eye out for union organizing, going so far as to use undercover spies to infiltrate union meetings. If none of those tactics worked, Ford simply fired thousands of workers who dared to speak out for a union. Despite all of this, the push for a union continued to grow. The effort was fueled in part by work speed-ups that led to more and more on-the-job injuries. Members of the Communist Party took a lead in organizing at Ford. This led to howls from the press about the Red influence. Finally, on April 2nd, workers walked off the job to protest yet another round of firing union organizers. Some 85,000 workers marched in 27 picket lines. Despite Ford's effort to create a racial divide, more than 80% of the black workers joined the strike. Finally, today in labor history, Ford agreed to sit down with the United Auto Workers. At long last, one of the most anti-union employers in the U.S. had been brought to the bargaining table. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Got an email from Mickey listening on WAUK in Milwaukee. He says, Clarence Thomas is a crook. You're too easy on him. He should be impeached. We need to be as hard as the GOP. He said, look at Tennessee. They didn't play any games. They expelled the two black men for being out of line. Mickey, I don't disagree. We're kind of easy on these folks. The Clarence Thomas thing, seriously, is a big deal in my view. And it should be something that people across the political spectrum look at, because it's the reality of where we are. You know, the right is losing their mind over Hunter Biden's laptop, over the fact that Hunter Biden had some business deal that he was able to profit off of using his name. And look, politicians' kids and relatives have been doing that from the beginning of time. I remember the first politician I remember. Remember Billy Carter with Billy Beer? Of course he was trying to sell his crappy beer off of his brother's name. This is how this is. And you expect that. But when people are in political office, like Clarence Thomas is, this is where this is different for me. He got caught with his hand in the vacation jar. $500,000 gig. And this is, you know, one of many. And it's not just him. I'm not focusing just on Clarence Thomas. It should be all of them. The fact that they have such lax ethics rules that if you have a personal relationship with someone, you don't have to, you know, they give you $1 million, you don't have to report that. No, they're just being friendly. It's crazy. It's crazy. And on both sides of the aisle, if we had a functional democracy, if we were in a functional system, both sides would be going, Clarence, what is wrong with you? Now, again, this is one of these moments where years ago, and it's got to be now, 10 years ago. Clarence was on, I think it was 60 Minutes, him and his wife, and they're driving this giant, big old RV, and he's talking about the things that, he's gotten from, you know, the this statue and the this, and they live in a palatial estate, man. At a time when Antonin Scalia was crying poverty because they don't make enough money. And I remember asking at the time, how is it they afford this kind of a lifestyle? Now you go, well, you know, they're big-time attorneys who make big money. Not Clarence. Clarence was not the high-powered attorney. He was a government attorney. He was the head of the EEOC for a while. He made okay money, but he wasn't at the top of the game. This is an important moment. And we've been in these before where it's painfully apparent that the system's broken. You know, as I've said a number of times, you know, I don't believe that there was a quid pro quo here. And this is where you get into some gray area. I don't believe that Clarence called up his buddy Harlan and said, hey, buddy, I want to go on vacation. You know, take me on $500,000 vacation. I don't believe that to be it. I believe it is you're part of the clan. You're part of the cabal. You're part of the group. You've been ushered through the Federalist Society. You've done the party circuits. You know each other. You're friends. You're all friends. You know, 1,000 of your closest friends as part of the Federalist Society who all have the same ideological agenda. You're all looking at the same prize, more for you, less for everybody else. It's this kind of narrow-minded ideology that's the only way you get in the door. It's not like they said, Clarence, we're going to pay you for this decision. No, he was put on that court because he was going to make that decision no matter what, because he had been groomed all along to be that mindset. This isn't hard to figure out. The right has done this masterfully. They have created an entire system, and you've got to give them credit because they're masterful at it. You get into being a low-level campaign person, then you work your way up to working on a congressional campaign, and you work for a congressional office, and then you get yourself a think tank gig, and then you go back and forth between government, then you get yourself another think tank gig, and you start moving through different agencies, and they're vetting you all along the way. And the chosen few, they move forward with bigger and bigger prizes and bigger payouts. Till eventually they get put on these really important positions because they've been vetted. They know exactly what he's going to decide. There's no surprises. What's interesting to me is that Clarence Thomas has said something. There were decades Clarence Thomas never asked a question on the court. He already knew where he was going. He knew what his decision was going to be. He didn't have to ask. He already knew. I find it interesting he's talking now because he knows this is bad. Now, the Boberts and the MTGs and all of the right-wing blathering idiots are out there going, no, Clarence is a hero. Clarence is our guy. We support Clarence. Clarence is in trouble. Now, is anybody going to hold him accountable? No. He's not going to be impeached. The House isn't going to do that. But there should be an investigation. There should be people looking into this. And we should be demanding it. You, me, us. Because when a crook is a crook, you hold them accountable. Speaking of crook, I got to throw this out real quick. Evidently an Ohio charity, Ohio Clean Water Fund, evidently is I guess, now being sued by the Ohio Attorney General because they raised a boatload of money, somewhere between, $140,000, $141,000. And evidently, you got to give them credit, I guess, on a certain level. Evidently, $131,000 of the $141,000 ended up in the pockets of the people who ran it. It was a giant fleece job. It was supposed to go to the people of East Palestine, supposed to help get them water and do all this stuff. Evidently, that didn't happen. So there is a lawsuit going to hold them accountable, and we'll see what happens. I hope jail time. should be what it is. Now, when I saw it, I saw Ohio Clean Water Fund. And I'm going, wait a second. And then my mind went, no, that's Clean Water Action. They're actually a reputable organization fighting for clean water for everyone. I went to the Clean Water Fund's website. It's all about just donations. So it's one of those things where you go, man, these more than 3,000 people who thought they were giving money to the people of East Palestine, they got screwed over. And even though it's a Republican in Ohio doing it, he's doing the right thing, and I support him. That's how we should be doing things. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.